next week, depending on how much spare time there is, what Gerald took to it, or maybe the week after. It's quite a long paper, I think it's about 55 pages, so maybe look at sections 1, 2, and maybe 3, if there's time, but for anyone interested in looking at that.
What's the title of that first?
Oh, good question. Something involving the words asymptotic safety, gravity, exact dodging. It's all this paper. Approximately the same set of words. Go.
Like something like conformally.
Actually, yeah. Hold on, I've got it. Yes. If you give me 2 seconds, yeah, I can just tell you. Yeah, so it's background independence and asymptotic safety, okay. Conformally reduced gravity. Okay, so I'll kick off. So in the last lecture, I talked about Wilson's picture of renormalization, but I didn't talk explicitly about the actual exact LG equations and their structure, so that's what I'll focus on predominantly in this lecture. So again, I'll start with a list, which by no means comprehensive, but of some of the useful literature. So there's these two papers by Tim Morris, which give this one in particular, this first one, a very nuts and bolts derivation of the exact LG equation from a particular direction. And this one's got much the same stuff, but in a slightly coarser form. There's the review I mentioned last time by Bagnalls and Bevilliers, which contains information on pretty much all the different forms of exact LG equation that there are. There's this very old paper here by Franz Wegener, which contains a nice review. And the most sophisticated approach is contained in this final paper by Morris and Latorre. The first four papers here are some of the original literature. So this, of course, is Wilson's big review. The term exact LG was actually coined pretty much simultaneously by Wilson and also Wegener and Houghton. And so this is one of the early papers on that. Then there's Polchinski's famous paper from around about 10 years later. And again, 10 years after that, there was what looked superficially to be an entirely different type of exact LG approach pioneered by Wetherich. So as I'll discuss, it's actually very closely related to Polchinski's formalism, in fact, by a Legendre transform. And finally, for the examples and the diagrammatics I'll talk about, there's a paper that myself and my PhD supervisor did, which contains the details of that. So I'll just recall some of the useful concepts from the first lecture. So as you may recall, the exact LG relates physics at different scales through a coarse graining procedure. And one of the things we'll look at in this lecture is how one utilizes the fact that there's a huge freedom in the way in which one performs this coarse graining procedure. And the point is that the universal physics is independent of how you do this. The other things that I discussed was to conveniently see the fixed point behavior, which was important for constructing continuum limits. One had to rescale all your dimensional quantities to dimensionless units. And along a renormalized trajectory, the action could be written in this self-similar form. So all the dependence on the scale here occurs only through the renormalized couplings and any anomalous dimension. So the outline of this talk, so I'll start talking about ERGs in the most general possible setting, talk about how to formulate them, and then I'll discuss some other ERG equations, which include Wetherich's. Then talk about some diagrammatics, and illustrate the use of the exact LG equation by showing how to compute the one-loop beta function, just in scalar field theory. And I'll conclude by recapping. So this is just a reproduction of one of the transparencies from the first talk, just to set the scene. So the starting point for everything was the partition function, where I've just tagged here that everything is cut off by some overall bare scale. So this is a high energy and short distance scale, and everything above this is regularized. So the action at this scale is the bare or the classical action. And the idea is that starting off at this high energy scale, we integrate out modes between this scale and some much lower effective scale. And the point is that the partition function, which is encapsulating the physics, must stay the same under this procedure. But we've integrated out modes. So the fact that these modes have been integrated out has to be taken into account somehow. And the way that happens is their effects are encoded in the Wilsonian effect of action S. So this action here evolves into this different action, the effective scale. So central to the entire implementation of the ExactRG is a cutoff. And this is how one, in practice, realizes this. So we can take the standard propagator, just the 1 over p squared, and just put in some ultraviolet cutoff profile. So this is going to be something which dies off sufficiently quickly in the ultraviolet. And here's a typical plot. So this, it needn't be straight, but this is one thing you could do. So it's straight along here, and then at the bare scale, it dies off rapidly. So this is the overall cutoff. As I said, we wanted to integrate out degrees of freedom between this and the effective cutoff. And the way that one can do this is split the overall cutoff into an ultraviolet effective cutoff and an infrared one. So here we go. So this is an ultraviolet cutoff now at the effective scale rather than the bare scale. And this is the complementary infrared cutoff. So for Polchinski's formalism and for flow equations of that general type, one uses the effective ultraviolet cutoff. The Vetterich's formalism, which is the Legendre transform, it turns out that one actually uses the infrared cutoff instead. So here is the Polchinski equation. I'm going to start just by writing it down. I'll explain what all the bits are, and then give a justification for where it actually comes from. So as I said, this is an equation which tells one how the Wilsonian effective action actually does change under infinitesimal variations of the scale. So here it is. So what are all the bits? Well, first of all, this S int is just the interaction part of the full action. So you can see that I've got the full action here. This is my regularized kinetic term, but I'm just calling everything else the interaction part. So it's usual but not necessary to include any mass term in the interaction part. I could, if I want to, include it in this bit, but most of the time it's included in the interaction term, for example. This object here, this delta UV, is defined as follows. So the dot on top just means minus lambda d lambda, and the delta UV itself is just this ultraviolet regularized cutoff profile. And the fact that this is in here makes sure that the flow equation is UV regularized. You can see that I've got these dots here, and this is just telling me to integrate over the undetermined coordinates. So if I Fourier transform to momentum space, then this thing will depend, let's say, on minus p, this thing on p. I've got an integral over p for the whole thing. And for reasons that will become apparent later in the talk, particularly when I discuss the digrammatics, this term is called the classical term, and this one is called the quantum term. So just for the future reference, I'm going to write up some of the key bits. Is there a board rubber here anywhere? Yes. So this is the Polchinski equation. And I'll also just add in that this delta here, UV, is the ultraviolet regularized propagator, and delta dot is just the flow of this. I'll put those up. So where does the Polchinski equation actually come from? And there are several different ways to derive it. So there's a very direct sort of nuts and bolts derivation, which can be found in one of Tim Morris's paper, where you take the partition function, you explicitly partition these modes. So you introduce your overall cutoff, then you introduce your effective cutoff with your UV bit, and your IR bit, separate things out, integrate out the modes, and derive the flow equation. And this is presented step by step in one of Tim Morris's papers. But there's a more flexible approach, which really makes it manifest where this blocking freedom that underlies the approach comes from. And this is where one starts by using the invariance of the partition function under the flow. You make the freedom of the coarse gradient process manifest. And this is what I'll discuss in this talk. And the most sophisticated presentation of this can be found in that paper I mentioned by Morris and Latore. So this is another transparency that I'm just reproducing from the first talk. And so this is about the formulation of very general exact RGs. So I'm going to, this formula here, I'm going to take as my starting point. So again, I'll just say what everything is, just to remind. So this lambda, of course, is my effective UV scale. It's not the overall scale, it's the effective one I've integrated out down to. These phi is just any set of fields. The S is the Wilsonian effect of action. And the reason that this is constructed in this form is so that the partition function is invariant under the flow. So if I integrate over d phi on both sides, then this just reduces the flow of the partition function, and the total derivative on the right-hand side then ensures that the partition function just flows into zero. This psi here is what defines our exact RG. So we've got a large choice in what we can choose. One particular choice will correspond to Polchinski's formulation of the exact RG and so forth. Parameterizes the blocking procedure, and we can actually adapt it to suit our specific needs, and in the final lecture on QCD, we'll do precisely that.
The top formula always equal to zero?
Ah, sorry. This integral is over dx, not over d phi. Okay. So here's the flow equation itself. So now if I just expand everything out here, you can see obviously this d phi can hit either blocking functional, or it can hit this term, and this is what generates for me my classical term and my quantum term. Oh, x is just position, coordinate, so it's phi of x, field of at point x.
It's action, the action integral?
Sorry?
Does it come from the action integral?
I've got my field phi of x as usual, right? And what I've got on the left-hand side has no explicit dependence on any of the coordinates. Everything's been integrated over. So I've got to have the same thing on the right-hand side. Just like normally, when you've got some vertex, you'd have an integral d dx, let's say phi of x to 4, something like that. Is this kind of idea? Sorry? Ah, sorry, that's exactly what I'm going to come on to. So this is what parameterizes the blocking procedure that you're using, so how you're integrating over the high momentum modes. There's a large freedom as to how you choose it, and I'll discuss explicitly now some of the choices one can make. So how does one choose psi? Well, there's some very general requirements. So first of all, it has to incorporate the ultraviolet regularization. And it also turns out that you need the flow equation to be nonlinear in S. And this is discussed in the review of Wegener's that I mentioned in the introduction. So let me just suppose that I take the following form. So I'm going to take psi like this. So I've got my ERG kernel, so this thing here. And this incorporates my cutoff function. So this is what's going to ensure that the flow equation is UV regularized. And I'm going to take sigma to be linear in S and just with some extra bit there. So because psi is linear in S, the flow equation is nonlinear in S. It's going to have S squared terms. Now, this S hat here is something called the seed action. And what you can think of it as being is a non-universal input which controls the flow. So you can imagine that your flow starts off here, it wanders around in parameter space to some point down here. How it gets there isn't really that important, and the seed action will change the precise trajectory that this thing takes. But the universal physics at the end of the day is going to be independent of this choice. So given that psi parameterizes your blocking freedom, if you choose this form, you've still got some residual freedom, and that's all contained in the seed action. And you can think of it just as an action. It's got the same structure and the same symmetries as the Wilsonian effect of action. So you could expand it in terms of fields. So you could have a kinetic term, you could have a four-point term, you could have a six-point term, whatever you want. And if you take the seed action to have any interactions at all, then the resulting flow equation turns out to be a generalization of Polchinski's equation. Now, for scalar field theory, it's actually not necessary to take a complicated seed action. You can just take it to have a kinetic term and forget about it. But for gauge theory, it's actually required that you take a more general form. Not at this stage. No, that will come when you go from the Polchinski form to the Wetterich form. This is just I said, a representation of the residual blocking freedom you've got. So psi is extremely general and is the most general blocking function you can write down. Suppose that you choose this particular form, which has restricted it. What freedom do you have left? Well, that's contained in S hat. You could then restrict S hat further and have none left, but that's the where that comes from. So what are the properties of good flow equations? Well, you've got general constraints, so the flow equation has to be UV regularized, and the partition function must be invariant under the flow. And also blocking has to be only over a localized patch. So, you know, you're averaging over groups of spins as we were in the first lecture. You only want the interactions that you generate occur over some local patch here. And in particular, you don't want any long-range interactions, any non-localities appearing after any finite number of ERG steps. And if one did find that, you'd actually get infrared singularities generated in the flow equation. So given these general constraints, what constraints exist on the seed action? Well, it has to lead to convergent momentum integrals, just because of that part. And one demands that it has a Taylor expansion in small momentum. And this is sometimes called quasi-locality. So we've got this very, very general blocking function, this rather abstract formalism where I've written down that I want the partition function to be invariant under the flow. I've got this thing psi, which I'm claiming is a blocking function. But how do I actually know that the flow corresponds to integrating out? If I just choose some psi, you know, how do I know that what I'm doing is actually an integration out procedure? So the argument goes as follows. So we know by construction that the flow equation is regularized in the ultraviolet by lambda. So that means that any contributions from momentum, some momentum scale Q, which is larger than lambda, are going to be suppressed. So you can see that as lambda tends to zero here, for any non-vanishing momentum, the contributions from this scale are going to vanish. But we said that the partition function is invariant under the flow. So if all these contributions are apparently disappearing, the partition function is invariant under the flow. They have to have been incorporated somewhere. And the only place they can be incorporated is into the effective action. And so this tells us that the flow equation must correspond to integrating out. So it's really these two crucial things of the flow equation, that the partition function is invariant under the flow, and that everything's UV regularized to ensure that things like this work. So here is the generalized potency equation. So this was just the general form of the flow equation for arbitrary psi. I took psi to be of this form, just to remind that this sigma as the action and the seed action, and then I can just substitute this directly into here, and I find this structure again where this term has just become this term, and of course this term has just become this term. And you can compare it to the Polchinski equation itself, and you can see that they've got an extremely similar form, so it's useful to actually make the explicit link between these two equations. So what I'm going to do is define the reduced action, SR. Now, this bit here is basically my regularized kinetic term. And if I choose this to be as over here, this will be my interaction part of the action. However, I haven't really specified precisely what this is going to be in this more generalized approach, so I'm going to call this SR rather than SINT, but there's a very close relationship between them, as I'll spell out in a second. And I'm going to do the same thing with the seed action. So the left-hand side of the flow equation, which just contained a minus lambda d lambda of S, you can see that I split this up now into my reduced part and my kinetic term. And then, of course, this part just gives this. And if I allow this to hit this, then I get two delta minus ones and a delta dot. So this is the form of the classical term now. So again, this is just splitting S up into the reduced part and the kinetic term. And this is splitting up the sigma term. So sigma, if we recall, is S minus 2S hat. So here's the reduced part of S. Here's the reduced part of the seed action. And now you can see, because there's two of these and only one of those, and this comes with a minus sign, this guy has an overall minus sign. So if I just look, if I start to multiply this out and look at, focus on just this term and this term, I get this, which actually will cancel against the corresponding contribution on the left-hand side of the flow equation. So the bottom line is that when I expand out everything in terms of this, everything which is left has at least one instance of the seed action or the Wilsonian effect of action. There's no terms like this containing neither. This propagator, no. So the form of this propagator, this is something like this form. So in the Polchinski case, it has exactly this form. I haven't actually specified precisely what it is here, but it's going to be something that's regularized in the UV. There's no IR regularization here.
IR
divergence
doesn't mean.
Okay, so that's a good question. So the flow equation itself, when you look at the terms, you write out the form of the flow equation, there's no IR divergence present. Now you can ask what happens when you start to integrate out. And this is the whole thing about you only want blocking over a localized patch. So if you've only got blocking over a localized patch, essentially as long as you perform only a finite, well, as long as lambda stays finite, perform a finite number of ERG steps, then the whole thing remains local, and you won't generate any IR singularities within the flow equation, as long as it stays local. So that puts some constraints on your seed action or your blocking function. And this doesn't have any effect to the quantum term. This counts, right? So the quantum term is unaffected because it just contributes to a vacuum energy. The quantum term has got two derivatives. This gives a vacuum term. So here's the generalized flow equation, and I'll just write this one up as well. So you can see that this first classical term is extremely similar to the corresponding Polchinski one. I've got this extra bit, which involves just seed action contributions. And I've got my quantum term. So that's the general form. And we can now see that this will reduce to this given the following choices. So first of all, I can take my kinetic term just to be the same as in the Polchinski case. I can set the interaction part to the seed action to zero. And in this case, I can just identify this reduced action with the interaction part of the Wilsonian effect of action. So that's the relationship between the two. So one thing which is useful to do is to explicitly include the anomalous dimension in this game. So as I said at the beginning, one of the reminders from the first lecture was if you want to really uncover critical behavior and fixed points and so forth, then what you need to do is you need to rescale everything into dimensionless quantities. Now, the part which involves the canonical dimension is just trivial, but there's an additional part which involves the anomalous dimension. So you need to always rescale by the full scaling dimensions. And it's useful to perform this rescaling, but it introduces a slightly awkward part of the flow equation, which one can then get rid of using the correct prescription. So I think this is what I just said. So under renormalization, the two-point vertex picks up this field strength renormalization factor. And so to get rid of it, I want to perform a rescaling. So I can now just do a change of variables. And what I find is that the left-hand side of the equation just picks up something depending on the anomalous dimension. So the anomalous dimension is just the flow of this z here. So it's not surprising that when I change variables, I pick up something like this. Now, the annoying thing is that if I look at the right-hand side of the flow equation, which has these d by d phi parts, then I pick up this 1 over z here, which is an irritation. And there's a very nice solution to this, which really highlights the strength of taking this very generalized approach to exact RG. And you can just actually drop the 1 over z to 1. So the point is that although the flow equation is now not directly derivable from the one before by a change of variables, it's still a perfectly valid flow equation. So the partition function is still invariant under the flow. You can still choose some blocking functional psi to get this flow equation, but the point is that the psi is different from the one that I used to get this equation here. But it's still a perfectly valid choice. It just gives a more convenient flow equation. So this illustrates some of the freedom, or rather illustrates how one can turn the freedom in the blocking to one's advantage. And so this is the form of the generalized flow equation where these 1 over z's have just disappeared. And this was first derived in the following paper by Ball et al. So in the third part of the talk, I'm going to talk about how to compute the one-loop beta function. And so I'm just going to do some preparation for perturbation theory. And for that purpose, it's convenient to bring 1 over lambda outside the action. So that just means that lambda will then be guaranteed to count the loops in a convenient way. And I can do that just by rescaling phi. And so now the effective action has this form. So these are the classical parts with a 1 over lambda in front of them. We've got 1 loop corrections, 2 loop corrections, and so forth. And the flow equation takes this form. So when I do this change of variables, I get another correction that's incorporated into here. So this new gamma twiddle is just related to the old one, as so. I'm usually just going to drop the tilde here. And this sigma lambda just has picked up an extra factor of lambda. And that's from this rescaling here. This causes an extra factor of lambda to occur on this side of the equation. So this has got exactly the same content as the previous flow equation. It's just related by a direct rescaling. There's nothing that's been dropped here. So I'm going to briefly discuss other ExactRG equations. So what other ExactRG equations are there for the Wilsonian effective action? Well, there's Wilson's ERG equation, and that corresponds to the following choice of blocking functional. Now, there's some claims in the literature, actually, that Wilson's formulation is equivalent to Polchinski's up to a change of variables, but if you rescale the cutoff out of the field, you can go from one to the other. Now, I've actually tried doing this rescaling, and it doesn't seem to produce Wilson's equation from Polchinski's equation. So I'm either going mad, which should perhaps not be precluded, or the statement's not correct. But either way, this is the blocking functional one uses for Wilson's equation. And there's also the Wegener-Houghton equation, which I mentioned at the beginning. And this is a sharp cutoff flow equation. And one needs to be careful, because the sharp cutoff limit of Polchinski's equation is actually ambiguous. So one needs to take care deriving this, and that's what Wegener and Houghton did. And as I said, they coined the term ExactRG at the same time as Wilson. So the other form of the effect of the flow equation, so these were all things which were in terms of the Wilsonian effective action, is the ones in terms of the so-called effective average action. And it's this object which Reuter is, for example, using in his asymptotic safety scenarios. So one way of viewing this is just a Legendre transformed version of the Polchinski equation. So to derive this, I'm not going to derive it, but this is how one could go about doing it. There's two ways of doing it. You can integrate over modes, and if you start off with the partition Z, define Z lambda as the partition function resulting from having done this partial integration out, so from the high momentum modes down to some effective scale. Then define the classical field as usual, but with respect to this Z lambda. And you define the infrared regulated generator of 1PI diagrams as follows. So this is similar to the usual Legendre transform relationship between the action and what one would call the effective action. But you see that now I've got this cutoff appearing explicitly. And just one thing on the nomenclature here, the reason this is called the effective average action is as follows. So usually what sort of away from the ExactRG, you have the action, and you'd call gamma the effective action. The trouble is, in this game, S is already called the effective action, or the Wilsonian effective action, so you need a new name for the effective action. Right? So rather than calling it the effective action, it's called the effective average action. So that's why it's got this average in front of it, or in the middle of it. And the flow equation for the average effective action is as follows. So it's got this very simple one-loop form. So this guy here, which you can see is raised to the power minus one, this plays the role of the full propagator. So it's like a one-loop equation, but with a full propagator rather than just the perturbative propagator appearing. This derivation, which makes very, very clear the relationship to the Polchinski equation, is in Morris's paper. And for a completely different derivation, see Vetteris' paper. And he just starts out with a partition function. He puts in an infrared cutoff. There's no explicit relationship made to Polchinski's formalism at all in that case. And it's a very nice derivation. This is a very nice paper. And the two approaches are completely complementary and give the same flow equation. So I'm not going to talk any more about Vetteris' form of the flow equation in this talk, but it will. Ah, right. So the two equations have different plus points. So in many situations, the effective average action approach is an easier one to implement. It's certainly easier often to do numerics with. And it has certain other advantages. So in the next lecture, I'll talk about the derivative expansion. And certainly at low orders in the derivative expansion, one can keep certain invariances of the exact RG manifest with this approach, whereas one can't with the other approach. That said, with the Polchinski formalism, there are other benefits that this has. The approach is far more flexible, and you can do things such as take an approach to QCD where you don't have to fix the gauge and where gauge invariance is manifestly preserved. So there's, I'd say, if you like, there's maybe advantages of sort of elegance and freedom in the Polchinski approach, but certainly if one wants to sit down and calculate at the moment, it's far better understood in general, I would say, how to do it with this quantity or with this flow equation. So I'll discuss some diagrammatics for the flow equation. Hopefully this will give more of a feel of how you can compute with it. And so, of course, I'm going to start off just by doing a field expansion for S, the action. So the first thing I might write down is a two-point term. So this half is just my symmetry factor. This is the vertex coefficient function. These are the fields, and there's matching arguments. So I've got two fields, so I'm going to call the coefficient function in front of them S2. And diagrammatically, I'm going to strip off the symmetry factor, I'm going to strip off the fields and just represent this coefficient function. So move on to the 4.1. Again, I've got my symmetry factor, my vertex coefficient function, my fields. Again, there's matching arguments, and now I just put two extra legs on my vertex. Now, the reason that I've got this big circle in the middle and not a dot is just one of convenience. So it emphasizes a few things. Let me just go over here. So, in fact, this is a perfect example here. So this thing here, just putting noughts on, so this is momentum here, would represent this vertex here. Often one might just write it in standard perturbation theory like this. And these are essentially the same. The reason that I put this big circle in here and an S inside it are for two reasons. So one is just to emphasize that all the vertices are non-perturbatively defined unless I make some approximation. So that's the first point. And the second point is that the seed action also has these vertices. So it's quite easy for me to put a hat on there, whereas I don't know, might be a bit more awkward here. But certainly in terms of diagrammatics, it's quite legitimate just to sink these circles down the point. They don't represent anything, they're just notational. And then, of course, I've got all the other possible interactions that I'm allowed by the symmetrism and so forth. So how do I then get a diagrammatic realization of the flow equation? Well, let's look at the classical term to start with. So what I've done here on the left-hand side is my minus lambda. I've just started substituting in the diagrammatic expression for S. So I've suppressed it at the two-leg term, but I would include all the other interactions as well, but I haven't got the space to put them in. Then on the right-hand side, I've got my factor of a half. Then here for S, I've done the same expansion. Do the same expansion for sigma. Now you can see why I've used this notation. So I've got an S in this circle, I've got a sigma in this circle. And now I just put in my derivatives. So what's going to happen is this derivative here is going to hit one of these two fields. It's going to pull out a factor of 2, which kills the symmetry factor. And the same thing's going to happen down here. And you can see that intuitively, you expect this line to join up the two fields here. And if you keep track of the momentum or the position in indices that all these fields carry, you can confirm that's the case. And so you get the following thing. And now you can see that these two fields are, of course, the same as these two fields. The factor of a half are the same, so I can just strip everything off. And this is my diagrammatic flow equation. And the plus dot 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 just means that I haven't included the quantum term yet. So the quantum term is easy enough to do, and it has the following form. So one can understand this as follows. So if I just go back to the classical term, you see that what I've got these two functional derivatives. So if you like, you can think of this, I've got two circles here, one representing S and one representing sigma. The functional derivatives, you like, knock a hole in them, and then I join them together with a line. For the quantum term, I've only got one circle here. I've got two derivatives striking it, so I knock one hole at the top, one hole in the bottom, and I need to tie everything back around together. And so I get this kind of structure. This line with a dot on it, the reason it's got the dot on it is just to represent the fact that I've got a delta dot appearing here, which just to recall is the flow of delta. So the full diagrammatic flow equation just takes the following form. So I've included my anomalous dimension here. And what this notation means here, this n, is it just means that I've got n fields and I distribute them in all possible ways. So if I've got two fields, then what I could do, I could put one here and one here, or I can put them the other way around, and this will give me a factor of two. If I've got four fields, you know, I can put three of them up here and one of them down there, or I can put one of them up here and three of them down there, and so forth. So I just distribute them in all possible ways, count up the combinations that are the same, and that will determine my combinatorics. And just a reminder, sigma lambda here is S minus twice the seed action, but with a lambda in front. That was just from my rescaling to make perturbation theory convenient. And so with this rescaling, I have the following form. So in fact, I can say at this point now why the first term is called the classical term, the other one the quantum term. This has the structure just of a tree diagram, whereas this one has the structure of a loop diagram. Now, it's important to remember that this is a tree diagram, but with respect to renormalized quantities. So I've already integrated out from lambda 0, from the Bayer scale, down to lambda. So this isn't like a Bayer tree diagram, it's a renormalized tree diagram. So it does have quantum corrections in it, but it has a tree structure. So this now is the flow of the reduced vertices. So I just thought I'd put it up and then show where the bits come from. So I've got this equation over here. This is my flow equation. I've also got my gamma that I haven't bothered putting in here. And so you can see that on the left-hand side, I've got my flow of the reduced vertices here. This bit, well, the gamma term comes from the thing I've suppressed there. The reason I've got a beta is because I've done this rescaling. Come over here. I did a rescaling so that there's a 1 over lambda outside the action. So the action has this form. When lambda d lambda hits this, it can either hit this bit or it can hit this bit. And I've got that lambda d lambda, lambda, this is just my definition of the beta function. So whenever the flow hits the coupling, one gets a factor of the beta function. And then I've got my classical term which has SR and sigma R. I've got this term containing just the seed action, and I've got my quantum term. More than one coupling constant. Right, you mean what would I rescale with respect to? Well, so it's a matter of convenience, really. So there's a good example, in fact, in Yang-Mills, because what happens is that the regularization procedure that one uses in infectology, in fact, introduces precisely an additional coupling constant. And, well, what do you want to do? You want to choose the coupling constant so that it's conveniently counting the number of loops. So in that case, you've got a physical coupling constant, an unphysical one, and you choose to take the physical one outside just to count the number of loops. So it's a rescaling of convenience. It's certainly not something you need to do. And so you just look at the problem and choose whichever makes sense to do, or you need to do it at all. So this is the form of flow equation. And so here's an example of the flow. So let's look at the classical four-point vertex. So here is the four-point vertex, and I just labeled the momenta here, P, Q, R, and S. So minus lambda to lambda, remember I'm often going to represent that just by a big dot. And so what I get, well, I've written down one of the terms. I've written down the term that's generated by this. So this has a delta minus one vertex, two-point vertex down here, and a seed action vertex, as so. And these ellipses just represent, well, first of all, what I can do is I can have put, instead of P here, Q, R, or S, and then I've got all the other terms. In fact, let me just write up. The form of general flow equation. This will be useful when it comes to doing the beta function. So what we've got? Got flow. So this is essentially what's on the left-hand side of the equation. And this n, as I said, just means that this is an n-point vertex. We've got bits involving the kinetic vertex. And actually, there's something I should add here. This vertex always has to be 2-point. This is the way I've defined it. So if n is equal to 2, this term contributes. It's not equal to 2, it doesn't appear. And what this is equal to is this classical term here, minus the 1 with just the seed action appearing, again where this has to be a two-point vertex. And the quantum term, and always with the same n fields which are distributed in all possible ways. So at the classical level, I only have classical terms, gamma star for one loop, beta star for one loop, so I can ignore all of those, which is why on the right, left hand side of this top list. Again, this is obviously a one loop diagram, so at the classical level I can drop it. I've explicitly drawn down this one there, and the dot 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 also, of course, includes all the things I can write down for this one. Yep, so that's the thing I've been missing there. So here's a complete example. I'll do the six-point vertex, but I'll use an abstract notation. So these are the only two diagrams, as I just argued, which contribute at the classical level, these tree terms. I've got six fields, so I've got six fields here, and as I said, the rule is that I put them in all possible ways around the diagram. So I will actually write this one up explicitly because I'll need to use this one in a minute. So the 6.1. And the zero inside the vertices is just to remind me that it's the classical part of the vertex. So I can, of course, replace the six with n, and it makes no difference. And one of the things that we'll see shortly is how it is that the seed action actually starts to cancel out the universal quantities. So I made this statement that the blocking procedure shouldn't affect the universal physics. And we'll actually explicitly see in the calculation of the beta function how these non-universal details do start to cancel out. So here is how to compute the one-loop beta function. So this is the setup for massless scalar field theory in four dimensions. And what I'm going to use is I'm going to use perturbative self-similarity. So the type of flow that I'm going to imagine is as follows. So I'm going to work in the massless theory. So this is the Gaussian fixed point here. And I'm going to consider some flow which is in the critical surface of the Gaussian fixed point. Now, as I made a big deal about last week, this flow is almost certainly not self-similar. So in other words, my vertices will depend on coupling lambda, the anomalous dimension, but also things like lambda over lambda zero. And I said last time that if I send lambda zero to infinity, I start to develop these renormal on-poles, and perturbation series isn't well defined. And I certainly don't have self-similarity. But if I just want to do perturbation theory and not worry about these considerations, then I can formally get rid of these, and the flow that I have left is self-similar. Now, this is just a trick to make perturbation theory convenient for this case. It's certainly not a claim that the trajectory really is self-similar. It's just recognizing that these violations of self-similarity are small non-perturbative effects. So this is what I'm doing here. And to calculate beta 1, we'll actually exploit this self-similarity. So when we come to compute it, we'll be able to assume that the only things running are these guys. There's no hidden couplings anywhere. But it is just the trick. So to actually get numbers out, I need to specify my renormalization conditions. I need to define what my couplings are. And I do this as follows. I'll take the two-point vertex, and I'm going to have it canonically normalized. So here I've got this p squared. So this, of course, is just saying that the kinetic term has this form, plus order p to the 4. And I've also included something which looks like a mass term. But this is not a mass itself, I just say. So the canonical normalization means this is unit coefficient. And the mass is implicitly set to zero. So although the thing looks like a mass term here, I've introduced no additional mass scale. It's only lambda that's appearing at this two-point term that doesn't depend on momentum. And as I integrate all the modes out, lambda tends to zero. So there's no mass developed here at the end of the day. And one can just determine this thing that's self-consistently. And so finally, I'll specify what my ERG kernel is. So move this back up. So for the Polchinski case, one can make this explicit choice. All I need to do here is say that if I invert this, it's p squared with unit coefficient plus all the p to 4 over lambda squared. I don't mind what these non-universal bits are. I don't have to specify to perform the calculation. I find that the details will cancel out. And the consequence of this is that the reduced part of the action is zero. And this is because, I'm just going to put my chalk. If we recall that S was equal to this, I said that this bit already has my p squared in. I said that the coefficient here is 1, or if I take the full thing with the symmetry factor, 1/2, there can't be any contributions left over in this guy at order p squared. So there's nothing coming from that. And so this is the effect of my renormalization condition for the two-point vertex. So for the four-point vertex, well, remember that I've rescaled phi goes to phi over lambda. I've pulled the 1 over lambda outside the action. So whereas usually I have a lambda phi to the 4 term, I've got an extra 1 over lambda appearing. So the coefficient is just 1, as I've defined things. And again, this condition is saturated at the classical level. So here's my action. This is the classical action. I'm writing this in the following form. And it means that all the contributions to the four-point vertex for the normalization I've chosen, they're all used up at the classical level. Beyond the classical level, there can be no further contributions. So to compute the beta function, I need to do two things. I need to look at the flow of the four-point vertex, which will determine the flow of lambda, and I need to look at the two-point vertex to determine the flow of the anomalous dimension, and then I'll have a pair of simultaneous equations which I can solve. So here's the flow of the two-point vertex. So you can see that I've just taken this equation here. I've just taken n equals to 2, and I've put the legs everywhere that I can. Now, probably can't read that, unfortunately. So what this says, can I, from this thing. It's not obvious how to. I'll write it up. Okay, right. It's more intelligent than it appears. So what I was going to say is, well, on the previous transparency, I mentioned how this part of the reduced action of order p squared is just zero by my renormalization conditions. So I can actually immediately kill most of these diagrams. See, all of these contain a contribution to that. And so this is the equation for beta and gamma coming from my two-point vertex. So it would be useful now to put this up. Let's see. Put it up over here. So the ones here for beta 1 and gamma 1, these just mean the one loop contributions. Everything's evaluated at order p squared, so I can just emphasize that these have momentum p flowing in. Right, so what I can do now is I can now, as promised, show how the seed action starts to cancel out in this calculation. So I want to consider this combination here. So, you see that there's a relative factor of -2 between these diagrams. I'm just going to consider that there. And what I'm going to do is, let's take this first diagram here. I'm going to rewrite this as follows. Remember that this dot is just minus lambda d lambda. So I can take this outside as long as I compensate with this term here. So the lambda d lambda can hit this guy, just reproducing the first thing, or it can hit the vertex, and so I need something to subtract that off. And I'm going to represent this as follows. So let's start doing this on the board now, I think. So what I've got this. It doesn't matter that there's two fields, I can put n fields here. And this thing, remember, I've often called delta, and I'm just going to promote this up here. So I'm going to remove it from here. And this just means, just as I can distribute n in all possible ways, I can also use this to decorate the diagram in all possible ways, which in this case just amounts to putting it back there. That's the only thing I can do with it. So what I want to do now is to expand this out. So hopefully I've got this equation still sitting there down there. So what this is equal to, 1/2. So this is just the first diagram. And I've got the second diagram. And I've got my n fields. But I mustn't forget that I've also got this delta sitting up here. And now I can do more things with delta. So over here, all I could do was tie it up that way. But here, I could say I could put it here, or I could also join things up that way. So let's suppose that I do that. So I'm going to take this diagram here. And I'm going to put the delta here. So I could have put it this way round, or the other way around, and so it comes with a factor of 2. I'm just going to remind that it is, of course, delta. So I've got a delta minus 1 into a delta, and that's just going to give 1. So what this thing is equal to is minus 2 star coming around there. OK, is that clear how those manipulations are proceeding? Well, which bit would it be useful to redo?
Well, I'll just go over the logic one more time. So this is the term, as I said, that I'm starting with, where I've got this object here.
This is just minus lambda d lambda of this. So you can think of the dot as just an operator. So I can move the dot to hit the entire diagram, and it can now do two things. It can hit the delta, which just gives me back what I started with, or it can hit the vertex, which gives me an extra term. So if I want this equality, I have to subtract this off. So now I want to look at the flow of this vertex. So that's what I've done here. But I've done just one additional step. Rather than explicitly drawing this line here, I've just put it up here. And that notation just means that I have to reattach it in all ways. So when I come to expand this out to this diagram and this diagram, when I put this on, there's now more interesting things I can do with it. I can put it this way, or I can put it this way, and so forth. So let me actually just reproduce the signs I've got here. So this was with a minus sign. So I've got a minus here. I've got a minus here. This becomes a plus. This becomes a plus. And let me just draw this one up here so it's nice and clear. I've got a naught hat r like this with a plus 2. And you can see that this is precisely the same form as this diagram here, but with the opposite sign. And so they, in fact, cancel each other. And it's also nice to see that this cancellation went through quite independently of what the fields were here. So although the calculation of the beta function involved two fields, I've done it with n fields here. And these kind of cancellations are completely generic.
Can I do that in a couple of minutes? So I've got precisely that coming up.
Yep. So I just want to continue the discussion of what one does. So I took my expression for the beta function, I just did those manipulations, and so I got this total derivative term left over, everything else cancelled out. And now I can do a similar thing with the four-point vertex. So instead of looking at the two-point vertex at all of p squared, I now look at the four-point vertex and I set all the momentum to zero because that's where my renormalization condition was defined. So I use the renormalization condition, arrive at a second equation for beta 1 and gamma 1, and then just solve for two simultaneous equations for beta 1. And what I get is this, and this is where I'll give explicit expressions to the diagram. So again, these should be the last thing that I have to write up. And one thing that one can immediately notice about this expression is that all the dependence on this seed action, S hat, has actually disappeared at this level. So I could have taken it to be whatever I like, and the result is nevertheless independent of it. So I've got minus, what is it, plus 3 over 2. Oh yeah, this has got P minus P squared. And just to note that if you actually contracted these things down to points, you get a diagram looking like this, which is just the standard one-loop contribution. So these have a very similar structure. Oh, and I've forgotten the most important bit, which is that the whole thing is hit by this, which is just minus lambda d lambda. So let's actually look at the first diagram here. So what I've got is the S naught K minus K P minus P. This is the vertex, so let's suppose that I take K to go around the loop here. So it's got four legs, 1, 2, 3, 4, carrying P minus P, K minus K. Yeah, so that's that part. The delta of K is just this bit here. And of course, then I've got an integral over my loop momentum, just as usual, and I've got the derivative. Now, what I want to do, before I said that thing, is I've got a derivative here, oops, and an integral, and I want to interchange the order. So can I do that? Well, the integral is ultraviolet finite by construction. And since the propagator, or rather this delta of k has this form, it only goes as 1 over k squared. If I do interchange the order, there's no infrared divergences that are introduced. So I've got this expression which has a d4k over k squared at most. There's no infrared divergences there, so I can interchange the order of differentiation and integration. So this is what I get, so I've just pulled this outside. And the point is that what remains over here is just dimensionless, and it must be dimensionless because beta 1 is just a number. So what I've got is I've got lambda v lambda of a dimensionless quantity. And the answer has to be 0, because I've got this cell similarity where I know exactly where all my scale dependence comes from and all my couplings. The only things that I've got lambda, little lambda, I mean, gamma, and lambda, with my perturbative cell similarity, meaning I've got nothing else. Now, these guys have already been taken account of. They've been pulled out. That was on the other side of the equation. And if I've got lambda d lambda for something dimensionless, well, I need some scale to put in here if I'm going to get a non-zero answer, but there's no scale available because I've got the self-similarity. So this diagram here has to vanish. No contributions from that. So given that I've got the self-similarity, how on earth, rather, can I get a non-zero answer coming from this diagram? And one can see this as follows. So let's look at the second diagram. So I set the external momentum to zero. So this guy here, if I take the loop momentum to be k, this is going to be a k minus k, 0, 0. And I've got two of these. And I've got two propagators now here, delta and delta. Again, it's UV finite by construction. But now interchanging the order of differentiation and integration will introduce an ultraviolet divergence, because these two together goes 1 over k to the 4. So there's 1 over k to the 4 here. Now, there's something important to note, and that's that there's no infrared divergence here. The infrared divergence just appears if I try to interchange the order of differentiation and integration. So, yeah, that's just a statement that there's an infrared divergence. And there's no need to interchange the order of differentiation and integration. One can do it without doing that. But it turns out to be much simpler to just use this as a trick to evaluate the integrals. So a convenient but by no means necessary for scripting, is to use a dimensional regularization as a trick. So change the number of dimensions to 4 plus 2 epsilon to regularize the infrared, and then I can interchange the order. So here's my integral again. And what I've done is I've written it in the following form. So I've got a kd minus 1 here because I'm working in d equals 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, not 4 dimensions. And I've expanded these guys out. So the vertices go as 1 plus order k squared. The propagators go as 1 over k squared. And the higher order corrections in momentum are what would make the cutoff go from sharp to smooth. So I've got a smooth cutoff, but first order, if you like, in momentum expansion is just sharp. And the reason I can drop these extra terms is because all the extra k squared terms get rid of the infrared divergence. As soon as the infrared divergence disappears, I know that the diagram vanishes. So I can just look at these contributions, which, after I've interchanged the order, give an infrared divergence. So now I shift k goes to k lambda, so it's a dimensionless variable. So this just becomes an integral from 0 to 1. And because of the dimensions, I pick up a lambda for 2 epsilon. So you can see that when the lambda hits this, it's going to generate for me a 2 epsilon. And this is going to be cancelled by the 2 epsilon coming from this integration. So remember that the epsilon was regularizing these integrals in the infrared. So when I perform the integral, I'm going to get a 1 over 2 epsilon, just representing the fact the integral is IR divergent, so I take epsilon to 0. And these two things cancel as they must. So this goes back to the statement that there is no infrared divergence in this integral, or rather in this expression. I can just arrange for there to be one as an intermediate step if I want to make the calculation simple. So I can then do this, do the integration, and evaluate this, and I get the following number, which comes out as minus 1 over 8 pi squared. So if I now feed this back into this diagram here, what I found is that this is minus 1 over 8 pi squared. You see, fortunately, the minus cancels against this, so I do get a positive beta function, and it comes out with the right answer. So just to conclude, I've just got a few comments about this. So first, we ended up with this universal answer. Well, so 2 points. The first thing is that we got already at this stage quite a high degree of universality because all the dependents on the seed action have cancelled out already. But at this stage, we still had these cutoff functions which could have any form that you like as long as they decay sufficiently quickly. But we nevertheless found that we are forced to look at the infrared end of the integral where all these details disappear. You're left with only the universal physics. And many of these cancellations are completely generic. So the cancellations are the basis of a so-called universal diagrammatic calculus, which is proposed by Tim Morris in the context of Yang-Mills. I've actually done a lot of work on this diagrammatic calculus and found out how to apply it non-perturbatively in the context of Yang-Mills. And when computing, for example, the beta function, it's now possible to go straight to the final expression. So I started off, I wrote down my flow equation over here. I did all these diagrammatic manipulations. I showed that the seed action cancelled out. I'd have had to have done exactly the same for 4-point vertex. And each time I'd have to redo it and redo it. But there's an algorithm sitting behind this, and one can just, if you understand the algorithm, you can go straight to the final expression. The cancellations are done for you. And there's actually, you can in fact replace, it seems, the diagrammatic manipulations just with some simple algebra. This is just something I'm working on at the moment. So to recap then, so to construct these very general exact RGs, we use blocking freedom. And I focused on Polchinski's equation and its cousins of the same sort of general form, but where the seed action was allowed to be more general. And I also incorporated the anomalous dimension in this convenient way by basically getting rid of the 1 over z factor. I introduced these reduced vertices. It's actually simple, extremely obvious thing to do, and it's really the almost trivial observation behind extending this calculus non-perturbatively. But it was only realized really quite recently to do this. So I showed how to compute beta 1. And as I just mentioned, there are some huge simplifications which are now possible. And I think these simplifications mean that, given this crucial proviso, if you're equally familiar with the two methodologies, so standard perturbation theory and exact RG perturbation theory, then it's actually no harder to compute the beta function in this method than it is with the standard means. Of course, the difficulty comes from obtaining the same level of familiarity, but inherently I'd say that there's no difference. So thank you very much.
any relation between cell similarity, fixed point, and conformal invariance?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, so critical fixed points, scale invariant fixed points, are conformally invariant. So there's no scale dependence at all.
Okay, how about cell similarity?
Right, so. So the whole thing that you want from the approach is you're starting off at some bare scale lambda 0, integrating up down to some intermediate scale lambda. So you've got some action which can depend on both scales. And the question of renormalizability is whether this limit exists. And you want the limit to exist, and you want to be able to absorb any divergences which occur into a finite number of couplings. If you can do that, it's renormalizable. So as I discussed in the last lecture, the simplest types of fixed point you can find are ones for which you've got scale dependence. So T is log U over lambda. So if I've got this, this is the condition essentially for a conformal fixed point. So it's a critical fixed point for the theory. And this is scale independent. So I can imagine I've got a fixed point here. I can now construct trajectories out of this fixed point, which in the neighborhood here, this trajectory spanned by the relevant and the marginally relevant directions. Okay, and the point is that the action along this trajectory, this is Wilson's so-called renormalized trajectory. So you can show very straightforwardly, as I did last time, that these actions are renormalized in a non-perturbative sense. And an equivalent statement is that the action can be written in cell-similar form. So all actions along a renormalized trajectory are such that the lambda dependent can be absorbed into the couplings like this. So you can turn it around. So if you want to find, say you've got some action, you're not sure whether it comes from a fixed point or not. If it's self-similar, then you can immediately say, oh, well, this is almost certainly something which is descending from some renormalized trajectory in the ultraviolet. And that's where the confusion can come with finite form. Perturbatively, it looks like it is self-similar. And so, although you're looking to flow into a fixed point rather than flow out, to say, aha, it looks self-similar, therefore, maybe it came from something in the ultraviolet. But then if you look more carefully beyond perturbation theory, you see that there are these explicit lambda over lambda zero confusions, which spoils self-similarity. So there's now no reason to expect that picture holds.
A curiosity, since you gave the beta for pi to the fourth, was that you had been stumbled upon this old result by Szymanczyk that for plus pi to the fourth, the theory is asymptotically free.
Right.
Which I suppose it simply means that that minus in front of the square bracket is a plus.
Yeah.
So that's why you have a negative.
Yeah.
What does it really mean in this case to be asymptotically free? So naively, one would say the non-perturbative,
yeah,
the functional integral, the quotient function is not defined because it's divergent.
Yes.
Into the phi to the fourth.
Yes. So, well, I think I'd say it as follows. So, the flow equation itself, I imagine, probably is well defined. Now, remember that the flow equation came from the partition function. So my guess is that there's a sleight of hand at that point there, because you've started with something which isn't well defined, because, as you said, you've taken that coupling that way, and you've ended up with a flow equation that you can compute with. So my guess is that that instability has perhaps become lost in the wash at that stage. But given the flow equation, you can never let's go ahead and you can do calculations, you can find that it's asymptotically free, and therefore you've got a relevant direction, a marginally relevant direction out of your fixed point. But if you then try to translate that back into actual physics, then I'm sure that you have to come across the problem that you just mentioned.
Okay, so for instance, so the fact that the theory is asymptotically free doesn't mean that you can make physical sense of it, right? It doesn't guarantee you.
Well, I think it means that you've got a solution which exists to your flow equation,
mm-hmm,
which makes sense as a solution to your flow equation.
But would that, for instance, allow you to access the mass spectrum
of the theory?
Which in this case,
which is unbounded from below.
Really,
I mean, my feeling is that, yeah, I think this is a true statement, that the flow equation, your flow equation can generate an awful lot of stuff for you, a large amount of which is complete garbage. You need additional physics to decide which of the solutions to the flow equation you're interested in, as opposed to not. But a really interesting case occurs if you just take the box out of the flow equation, this is done in Wegener's report, and just look for Gaussian solutions. You can imagine that all you find is a Gaussian solution with zero anomalous dimension. You, in fact, find what looks like a huge spectrum of Gaussian fixed points with just the condition that the anomalous dimension is integer. And that's what the flow equation tells you. Those are the solutions to the flow equation. And in fact, well, even more than that, you can have gamma star as anything. But then you look at what that really means, and for gamma star equal to non-integer, you find that all the solutions are non-local. So you decide, well, I don't want these non-local solutions, I don't, because I'm going to throw these out. And then you look at the other values of gamma star equal to that are not equal to zero. For each one of these, there's some reason, some physical reason, why you need to get rid of the solution, or why the solution isn't relevant to physics. So I think one needs to be careful with the flow equation. The flow equation produces
that's
some more...
That's why you don't feasible.
Exactly, yes.
Which one is this reference you just said?
Oh, it's the one by... Yeah, so... It's this one, by the way, the second one from the bottom, so the critical state general aspects. It might be a bit hard to get hold of because it's not in any journals. We need to find the actual book itself, but it's a really nice presentation.
All aspects of this approach to thermalization related with something having dimensional transmutation, no? Well understood because in this case the couplings, some couplings, no, like mass appears like spontaneous breaking of signals.
So yeah, so if you had a trajectory like the one in QCD where you've got renormalized trajectory at the Gaussian fixed point. So in QCD you've got here's your Gaussian fixed point. You've got something here where you've got G of lambda along here. Then yes, certainly you'd expect to see dimensional transmutation. Mm-hmm. So I mean, in particular, because the physics is always determined, universal physics, usually determined in the lambda goes to zero limit. So if you've got functions of your momenta, pi over lambda and lambda going to zero, something's going to have to happen to replace this scale lambda. And there are some heuristic arguments within this, the manifestly gauge invariant case, which I was talking about, which show at least how you expect this to come around. I mean, unsurprisingly, then if you look more carefully, you'll find that there's something along these lines sitting around that cancels. But yeah, you certainly expect.
In this case, for example, because the fermions, the condensation of fermions also. It's fully understood how the condensation of fermion is connected by the in the so the renormalization group. For example, that the fact that the possibility of generation of a large fermion condensate, for example, this kind of thing.
I mean, so presumably if you're talking about non-perturbative effects regarding the fermion dynamics. So in the exact RG approach,
for example, you
could in principle try to address these, but you'd have to find some approximation scheme within the set of equations that allowed you to access this. So you know the equations are exact to start with, but generally speaking you can't solve them. So you need to have some approximation scheme. Now within that approximation scheme, well, okay, so one point. So first of all, you want to capture non-perturbative physics, so you're not going to have any small parameters to organize this approximation scheme. It's quite possible that the inclusion of extra terms, you know, the extra terms might be more important. So what you need to try and do, and this is of course a bit of an art, is you need to find an approximation scheme such that the approximation scheme is reasonably stable, but it's also got enough terms that incorporate particular physical effects. So you might have a fairly stable approximation scheme, but you've missed out the terms that would be relevant to the effects that you're talking about, in which case you'd never see it. Mm-hmm. So you know, you have to play this game where you make sure that what you've got has got enough physics in it, it's got enough stability in some sense. Mm-hmm. But as long as you've got no small parameter, and as long as you, you know, and if it's not possible to do any better than this, you're always never really sure how well this thing is working.
The question is about if we, because the, for example, massless QCD is largely degenerate, in the three approximation, no? The massless QCD is largely degenerated. Then one wonder about the possibility of starting the perturbation expansion, not in the, using the starting use of button, or button having condensates of massless fermions.
So you want to the perturbation theory about
this will affect the solution considering this kind of things, or the discussion is independent of this kind of.
Well, so if I understand correctly, so you're trying to do perturbation theory about a different background?
Yes, a different starting background, for example.
So I think, I mean, it comes back to what I was saying before. You know, you're trying to ultimately introduce some approximation scheme.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know whether you can introduce that particular one.
The idea is to start from not from the use of button, from a button like a Banting-Cooper filter condensate, for example, of gluons and fermions.
So with your question, could you implement that in here?
Or if this will affect the solution you get from the discussion, if you consider this...
Well, no, the solution, if you could solve the equation, you know, the solution is the solution.
Uh-huh.
Right, it has a solution. But I think, you know, maybe your approximation would be a good one that captures some physics better than others, I don't know, but it might be the case that particular way of approximating the equations is good. I don't know. But I can try.
This discussion is not affected by the fact that the generating function is assuming the construction of the generating function assumes the usual pattern for the QCD.
No, the equation is exact.
It's exact in the rendered.
The challenge is how to solve it approximately.
Thank you.
Thanks.